Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'm excited to be here with you today moderating a webinar on statutory language and collection letters. The language used in collection letters today is coming under increased scrutiny by plaintiff's attorneys and judges from across the country. Even using the statutory language from the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is not necessarily safe in some districts. I'm excited to be joining a panel of from across the collection industry who are with me today to share their insights into what can and can't, what should and shouldn't be included in the collection. Being sponsored by CompuMail, you'll get the chance to hear more later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Shelly Gensmer is the Vice President of Legal and Compliance for ERC. She's been with the company for the past 2 years. Shelly holds a CCCO designation from ACA International and has more than 13 years of litigation and collections experience, ranging from first party, third party, legal to deceased collections. Michael Clutho is a shareholder with the Minneapolis law firm of Fassford Remily. A significant part of Michael's practice involves the defense of collection attorneys and collection agencies facing FDCPA, FCRA, and TCPA lawsuits. Michael has defended thousands of consumer lawsuits brought against collection professionals. His practice in this area also includes the defense of claims brought by governmental regulators overseeing entities involved in the credit and collection industry and risk management, audit, and advice. Michael chairs the firm's Consumer Law Defense Practice Group. He presents frequently on the FDCPA, FCRA, TCPA, and related issues, and is a certified instructor through ACA International. Michael is licensed in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Missouri, as well as many federal jurisdictions. Rick Purr is a partner with the law firm of Feinman, Krechstein, and Harris, and a nationally recognized authority on creditors' rights, including the FDCPA, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the TCPA. Rick, who is also a past president of ACA International, a trade association representing the debt collection industry, advises entities and individuals on matters related to compliance in the credit and collection industry, including review, implementation, and auditing of policies and procedures, especially in adherence with governmental regulatory bodies, such as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we will get to them as the discussion is ongoing and once the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and recording will be made available later today on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I want to ask everybody to take a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and find the speakers, like the ones we have with us today, who are the people you want to hear from. So I appreciate that in advance if you share your feedback. With that, let's launch into our discussion today. So let's start with a very easy question for the panel. Rick will give you the honor of the first question. What language has to be included in a collection letter?
Hey, give me the hard one. I will start with the caveat, of course, that all of us who are lawyers here may in fact actually be lawyers, but we're not necessarily your lawyer. So we're going to give you a bunch of advice, but maybe definitely double check with whomever you're working with to do letter review, which as a side note, we would recommend probably doing at least once a year, probably two times a year, given the case law that's out there. But
thank you for that disclaimer.
Yeah, but that being said, each state, of course, has, or many states have their own written requirements for what you need to put on a letter. Highly recommend that you check with the attorneys in those states or look at various resources out there to confirm what needs to be on the letter on a state-by-state basis. On the national level, there's a breakdown of a few different things that you want to make sure you get on the letter. across what's required from a disclosure perspective, the identifying who the communication is from, in which case, you know, identifying the company using its legal name, putting in there that the company is a debt collector, that the purpose of the communication is to collect a debt and information is going to be used for that purpose, and also under 1692G to make sure that you have the identity of the current creditor, having the amount that is owed, and all of these things, of course, are all loaded language, as many other panelists who are here will tell you. I use these words and phrases, but they have a lot of double meanings, and again, part of what our discussion will be here is some of the litigation that's developed on what do some of these words such as current creditor actually mean and how do you present it? What is the amount of the debt and what can you put on there? And of course, utilizing identifying three separate areas of statutory notices that need to be on the initial communication with the consumer. That includes advising the consumer that they may dispute the debt and have 30 days to do so, depending upon what jurisdiction you're in, whether that has to be in writing or not, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Telling the consumer that if they provide in writing within 30 days, request for validation that one will be provided, and lastly, that if the consumer provides a request in writing within 30 days of receipt of the letter, you will provide the name and address of the original creditor if different from the current creditor. So from a federal standpoint, that's probably a breakdown. If I missed something in there from one of the panelists, jump in, but that's sort of the very basic basics, which aren't very basic at all.
Rick, I just wanted to add something on there that you jogged my memory of. You mentioned, you know, adding on the state-specific type of things. I think we might talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But there were a rash of cases in Wisconsin where Wisconsin has, you know, a state-specific requirement that you say, you know, this agency is licensed by the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions and some other language. And folks were all dutifully putting that on their letters. But Wisconsin also has an exemption from licensure if you're out of state, only collecting for out-of-state creditors, you don't step foot into Wisconsin, those sorts of things, you don't need to have that licensure. But folks would dutifully, you know, we're sending letters into Wisconsin and, you know, we need to put that language on there. So they were all getting sued in class actions for stating that affirmatively that they are licensed in Wisconsin when in fact they are not. And that was some false imprimatur of, you know, the state vouching for them. And those lawsuits were, there were a lot of them, and they were working. So think about it in reality as to how you do it, and don't just by rote put something on a letter if in fact it isn't true.
Excellent. Good start to the conversation. Thank you very much. In the neighborhood of Rick and I here in the Third Circuit, there have been a number of cases where collection agencies have been sued for using the statutory language from the FDCPA in collection letters, specifically as it relates to the validation notice and disputes. Shelley, we haven't heard from you yet, so let me ask you, you know, how would you advise an agency, you know, be it your own or somebody else, sending letters in this neck of the woods to adhere to the FDCPA, but not necessarily run afoul of, you know, the legal precedents that have been set so far?
Thanks, Mike. And I'm sorry, I actually ended up getting kicked out, so I had to jump back in. So that's why I was so quiet.
Glad you made it back.
Yeah, me too. So we all know that the Third Circuit right now, and the Third Circuit even within itself, like, you know, between Pennsylvania and New Jersey, even, you know, within that circuit, they don't agree. So Pennsylvania seems, you know, absolutely insistent that, you know, you have to have the writing requirement and point the consumers to the writing requirement in the letters. New Jersey, on the other hand, has not found consistently for that to be the case. So, you know, even within themselves, they can't figure it out, right? So one of the cases was, I'm trying to think if it was the Graziano, that was rejected actually by like the first, second, fourth, sixth, and ninth circuits. And they all found that an oral dispute absolutely could trigger, you know, an FDCPA obligation. So for the Third Circuit, you know, because we're waiting on some bigger cases to go through appeal, I think, you know, the stance that seems to be pretty consistent throughout our industry, honestly, is don't change your letters. You know, there's been a lot of discussion back and forth about, you know, what adjustments can you make? Could you make adjustments specifically for Pennsylvania? And it seems that the consensus really is to just leave your statutory language in there as is. Like I said, there's so many other circuits that definitely reject what's been found in the Third Circuit at this point. And then truthfully, again, I know we're going to speak to this a little bit later on, but when you've got the CFPB rules that were released, the NPRM, I think that definitely clarifies some things. So I would say have a little bit of patience, just wait it out. As soon as you start to fix something, you know, are you inadvertently shining a light on, you know, the fact that you didn't have this in before? And then does that create an onslaught of lawsuits? That's one thought. You know, the other thing is, you know, I would just leave it as is, because as soon as you do make a change, you know that the Court of Appeals is going to find that what you had originally was just fine. So that's the consensus that I've found in talking with our industry peers. I don't know what the other panelists have found to be true.
Thanks, Shelley. This is Rick. You know, we practice a lot here in the Third Circuit and have dealt with this issue. And really, this is an issue that has morphed itself for years and years and years till its current state. And actually, as you noted, got some judges to buy in to this really ludicrous theory that the statutory language contained in the FDCPA is itself a violation of the FDCPA. And there are other judges that have rejected that approach. It's currently on appeal in a consolidation of, I think, 7 cases before the Third Circuit. And we probably will see a decision. They're scheduling it for oral argument, and we'll probably see a decision, you know, fingers crossed, before the end of the year. So your advice is sound in terms of don't change anything yet, because the circuit itself, the district courts, are split. But what in fact is really happening, and I think it's important for everyone to understand, is where's the origin of this? The Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, way back in a case, determined that the mandatory language that I noted at the beginning of the conversation, in which you had to tell somebody that they have 30 days to dispute a debt, and then followed it up with two other provisions of the act, which said that if you notify in writing request for validation, if you notify a request for the original creditor's identity in writing, that the debt collector has to provide it. Well, the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit said, well, sentence number one doesn't say in writing, but the Congress meant in writing. So we're going to require then that only if somebody disputes the debt in writing is a debt collector required to respond to that inquiry and that statement of dispute. By the way, after that case came out, plaintiff's lawyers, of course, took that to other circuits, and every other circuit rejected that reasoning. So in the Third Circuit, we have this bizarre in writing requirement that says for to make a dispute, it has to be in writing as well. So the court went on in a series of cases thereafter to say, okay, if you invite the consumer to call within that 30-day period, you are overshadowing this written dispute obligation. And so from there, you had a series of cases that said you put too many telephone numbers on your letter. That was an invitation to call. You said, if you have a problem, give us a call. If you need to contact us, this is our telephone number. And so that really expanded. So finally, the plaintiff's lawyers went so far as to say, you know what? The actual language of the FDCPA in 1692A3456 invites, in fact, the consumer to call and not to write. And so you got a couple judges that said, you know, if you put this language in there and you put the very language in there, you're not telling them it has to be in writing. And half the judges have bought into that and half haven't. It's before the Third Circuit. I would think that if the Third Circuit were to conclude in the plaintiff's favor, that it would go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And as we've seen with a number of other cases before the Supreme Court, Henson versus Santander, the Abdusky case, in which they said Congress says what it says and means what it means, that you will ultimately see a current U.S. Supreme Court rejecting the Third Circuit's view of the in-writing requirement in that initial section. But we have a long way to go. But that's the origin of where we get this ridiculous assertion that the FDCPA itself violates itself.
Yeah. And Rick, this is Michael Kluth, though. Just to pick up on something you mentioned about the Supreme Court, I just pulled up the German versus Carlisle McNally case, which is one of the FDCPA cases issued by the Supreme Court back in 2010. And the issue in that case, while it was a bona fide error and as a legal issue, a bona fide error type of thing, the underlying case was that the law firm had put a writing requirement and did not have the first sentence, if you will, that you could dispute orally. And the Supreme Court looked at that and ended up referencing the statute and saying, you know, the statute talks about a dispute can be oral. And the consumer lawyers on the flip side, a mirror side, whatever, brought the lawsuit. And so I don't know if this, I agree with you. I think that the Supreme Court ultimately will need to weigh in if the Third Circuit doesn't fix this. But the German case seems to give support to the notion that the statute is written. That's how you put it into your letter, and that's how everyone needs to go forward.
Excellent. Well, at this point, I just want to pause the discussion for a brief moment and say a few words about CompuMail, the sponsor for today's webinar. CompuMail is pleased to be sponsoring this webinar about a topic so vital to our business and the success of our clients. Since 1994, CompuMail has been delivering dynamic communications and services to customers around the United States, specializing in the accounts receivable, financial, healthcare, automotive, and utility industries. As a trusted full-service outsource provider that is 100% privately owned, CompuMail is large enough to meet the unique business needs of our clients, but small enough to ensure that each client is treated with care. CompuMail understands how critical safeguarding your data and ensuring compliance with the highest industry standards is of utmost importance to us. But CompuMail's expert team partner with you to assist with the seamless integration of your messages across multiple channels from design to delivery. And today I'm happy to have Alyssa Banks, CompuMail's compliance officer, and Jana Holve, executive sales support, with us from CompuMail. Thank you very much for joining us, Alyssa and Jana, and thanks again to CompuMail for sponsoring today's webinar. Shelley, you brought up a topic that we're going to spend a few minutes talking about now, the release of the proposed debt collection rule. For anybody who's been living in a cave for the last 2 months and doesn't know, the CFPB released its proposed rule, and in it, there was a model validation notice and collection letter that it proposes will be used in the collection of debts. So I'm curious to hear from the panel on what impact, if any, do you think the release of the proposed debt collection rule from the CFPB is going to have on collection letters, let's talk about now and, you know, in the future, on the horizon, you know, on the day that the rule does go into effect, you know, who knows when? Who wants to jump in first on that one?
I will just speak to that, like my opinion, and just doing some research and kind of bouncing off what's there and what we think is realistically going to change or adjust based on the comments that we've been kind of putting together collectively as an industry. I think, truthfully, the rules, having provided permission and guidance on the use of emails, text, social media platforms, along with the safe harbor language that's provided in the limited content message, I truly think that the days of the actual letters are probably very limited. It kind of has given us a little bit of a relief in there, just by providing what it is that we can use and say without A, having to risk the third party disclosure, B, you know, giving some guidance on how to tell our consumers to communicate with us. There's a tear off sheet on there that gives different ways that a consumer can check off what they want you to do and don't want you to do, or to do nothing at all. I think that really is going to clear this up quite a bit. And the fact that the new rules really adopted what's already in the CFPB, I do think that's really going to kind of put a little bit of a lid on the confusion between what's going to be acceptable in the letter and what's not. And I for one, am very excited about that. I think plaintiff's attorneys are going to have to get a heck of a lot more clever, because putting that material in our hands and telling us this is okay, you will be in compliance if you do this, I think that really just solves so many issues for us. I mean, granted, there are definitely some confusing pieces in there that sort of contradict, you know, there's like rules that are stated in the actual proposed rules, and then in some of the commentary up above, there seem to be some things that are contradictory, but I don't think in this area specifically.
Thank you. Go ahead, Rick, Mike, Michael.
I was going to jump in on a little higher level analysis of what we can expect in terms of the proposed rule from the collection letters, and maybe it's a little bit of wishful thinking on an industry perspective, but I think that, and it's a shame that on a similar note, a recent case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court dealing with the what deference has to be provided to the Federal Communications Commission with respect to its rulemaking authority. Would have been interesting to see what the Supreme Court says, because I think that had that case been decided, we would have had a better idea in terms of what to expect from the proposed rule from the CFPB. But I think that what we're really looking for here is a Chevron deference to the authority of the CFPB to put out these rules, and for courts to be required to adhere to them. In other words, if there is a model collection notice, which there appears to be, that complying with the model collection notice should provide some level of security and safe harbor to industry participants utilizing the letter in that format. It's a lot of wishful thinking in that to think that it won't be challenged at some point, or that someone's not going to change one word, or that there's going to be something in the letter that you need to add to it that's going to continue to create some possibility of a lawsuit. But I think what we're really looking at as an industry, and I know that industry groups that are submitting comments and have sought some input with decision makers, is it the intent of the CFPB to provide a safe harbor by utilizing its collection notice? And if so, is it going to say so expressly, or we're going to have to litigate that issue before the courts? But that would be a big deal if, in fact, the usage of the collection letter, much like the proposed limited content message that they have, would provide a safe harbor for industry participants.
Excellent. Thank you. Another topic that I've seen in lawsuits that have been filed against collection agencies with respect to letters and potential FDCPA violations have to do with including line items like service fees and interest and other charges on a collection letter when none are being added to the balance owed. I know there's, I think there's been some sort of, some back and forth and a little bit of uncertainty on that. So I'm curious to get the opinions of the panel on whether agencies should include those line items if none are being added, you know, to the balance. Michael, would you mind going first?
No,
I'm sorry.
Did you say Rick or Michael?
I was going to ask Michael to go first, and then you can follow
right ahead.
If you don't mind.
He knows more than me anyway.
Thank you. All right. Well, you know, there are some states that require this itemization. So, I mean, obviously, if their state law is more specific, you've got to do it. But let's get out of the state specifics and just say in general FDCPA land, whether or not you need to, you know, line item things. And if you have a form letter that has the ability to be able to, if an account has, you know, a dynamic balance, for example, where there's interest being added, but you're using it in a static balance account where interest is not occurring, and you list it as being zero under the interest column, that's where they are bringing claims. The same thing with any other, those, you know, boxes, if you will, in your matrix of describing the debt, where you're trying to use a letter to be a one-size-fits-all. I'm not a big fan of one-size-fits-all letters. I think you got to have a static balance kind of a letter and then a dynamic balance letter and maybe multiple versions of a dynamic balance depending on what sorts of things. But one of the things, this is clearly an issue that is getting a lot of attention, a lot of class action lawsuits being brought on letter claims with regard to this. One of the things that I've recommended to clients, and don't sue me if you do this and you get sued for it, but if you're going to use that kind of a letter and in a particular case, the interest is never going to change, you know, I'm recommending that you put N/A or NA and then have a sentence in the letter that explains that NA means not applicable and it will not change type of thing. So you can think about ways to make a one-size-fits-all letter less likely to be subjected to lawsuit or have a judge say, well, they explained it. I mean, even a least sophisticated consumer has to read normal English language. But it is an issue. It's an issue that you will get sued on if you just try and use a one-size-fits-all and don't fill in those blanks or leave those blanks as zeros and have it falsely or allegedly falsely imply they're going to change. So it's something you need to think about. What's the right answer, you. Rick?
No, that was the answer. It's always the right answer, Michael. You know, the only thing I would say is, again, go back to what I said about the model letter is, you know, there is a place in the model letter for fees and interest accrued post-charge-off. I would hope that the industry would be able to argue that the inclusion of that on the form, that even if you put a zero or an NA, as Michael suggested, the fact that that is there, even if there is no interest accruing at all, would provide that, because you're simply mirroring the language provided by the CFPB.
I agree wholeheartedly with you, and I thought that there was some language even in there, Rick, and some of the commentary that might have said that you couldn't get sued. I thought they'd, I'm going to try and pull it up while we're going forward.
I think it was their goal, and I know the industry groups have been pretty adamant in talking to the director and others in that ex parte session about making sure that that's the case.
Yeah. It's important.
I know we've had a few cases that were filed by one specific attorney in New York, and after the, you know, in the post Avila world, and after Taylor, you know, there's just so many different things that mold what you should and shouldn't do as far as interest and fees. I know ERC stuck with the NA thing for, and we also tried the $0 amount, and we've been sued on both. So it is kind of just, it's an interesting thing, and we find, I mean, I personally think that where we've put zero, we've actually gotten the cases dismissed, all of them, and the reason for that is you know, for ERC, there is never any interest accrued. And so the statement cannot be construed as having one or more meanings. It's got one meaning, and that one meaning is absolutely 100% correct. And we've been successful with that argument. Though my personal opinion, which, you know, I'm not sure in my ERC really really cares, because if it's working, right? I think that not applicable is a good way to go about it. And I agree that having that sentence in there, that NA means that there are no fees or interest occurring, is very helpful. Truthfully, what we found to be difficult is just finding the real estate in our collection letters to put that additional language.
Yeah.
So we've tried both. And we've had good successes with just the $0. And obviously, I have a cold, so I'm really sorry that I'm squeaking at all of you. I apologize.
No, you're fine. I'm going to veer off from our special topics right now and take a couple of questions that have been submitted by the audience, so we can try and get some of these out of the way, but also as an opportunity to remind everybody, if you have a question for one person or the entire panel, please type it into your Zoom webinar control panel and we'll try and get to it. A question come in. Have any of you heard of suits where a debtor alleged the collector violated the FDCPA by using the third-party disclosure provisions of the FDCPA by using a letter vendor? And I guess I would imagine the follow-up question, if you have heard of it, what advice would you have to defend against such a suit?
Those claims have been made from time to time. I don't think they've gotten any traction.
I don't think so either.
No, I agree. There's one that recently came out that I think it was making the rounds, and because no one's seen one in so long because they stopped doing it, it made some news. But the letter vendor, the arguments about the letter vendor probably come down to, I haven't looked at one of those cases in a while. Probably the letter vendor falls under the fiduciary exception of the term debt collector, and therefore it's not a disclosure because they're part and parcel of the collection agency itself. In that regard, no. Different than when a management company hosts an apartment complex and goes ahead and proceeds to collect dues owed to the homeowners association or other things along those lines. So, it made some news recently, but as Michael said, it comes up every time to time and gets knocked down pretty consistently.
Okay. Good news for whoever the person who submitted that question. A question on where someone can find the model letter. I'm assuming they're referring to the model validation notice from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the notice of proposed rulemaking. I'm trying to get that all out in one breath. You can definitely find that on the CFPB's website in the section on the proposed rule. And I keep in mind that that document is 538 pages long, but it is in there to get to the bottom. If you manage to read all the way to the end, skip through. Skip through. Yeah. so you can find that there. Another question that has come in: if a client sends us a batch of new collection accounts, and a debtor has 15 to 20, even 30 accounts in that batch, so for one person, how should we send letters for that debtor? Should they be sent each individually so they can dispute whichever they feel is needed, or just one letter that has all the balances listed? I don't feel like we should be sending 20 different letters to one person at the same time. Anyone want to tackle that one?
I always question, is that person going to pay? I mean, if they haven't paid 30 different accounts, but
that's a good point.
Different kind of a question. I think it could be done both ways. I think you can create a matrix and enlist them all and give them their validation rights and do it all in one letter. I think that the conservative wisdom is to give them a separate letter for each account. but I think you could do it either way. What do you guys think?
And I'm sure Shelly has a perspective, you know, in-house doing, working directly with the collection agency that's doing it. I mean, I know that my clients have asked me this question numerous times. And I go back to the statutory rights that everybody has and say, you know, it's probably okay to list each obligation on a single letter, or a case if you have 30, probably you need more than one page. But the key component that I believe a court will look at is, have you clearly conveyed to the consumer their right to dispute each and every one, or some or none or all, or picking out each one that they have to be able to exercise their rights to dispute, to seek validation, and to seek the identity of the original creditor, and that becomes paramount. If you're writing it and putting it in such a way that the person either becomes confused, misunderstands it, doesn't, you know, the argument that it overshadows the validation rights, is where you'll probably run into a problem. But if you set forth that and give them the opportunity, because maybe, you know, medical services 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are okay, and they have no dispute with that, but they have a problem with number 8, number 10, number 12, and you have to make it clear that they have the right to be able to individually pick those out and dispute that portion of the obligation they don't agree with. I think that's paramount.
I think that's exactly right. I think unfortunately the best way to go about that is to send each letter separately, because then you've laid out the ability to dispute each and every account. If you lump them all together, there might be some specifics that you have to list on each of those accounts that are different. And I think it just, putting them all together leaves a little bit too much room for confusion. I mean, if this consumer's in New York, I'm not really sure how you're going to list out all the things that you have to list out for each of those accounts and not confuse the debtor. I would say the safest way to attack that would be one letter per account.
All right, good advice. Moving on, I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about the state disclosures. It's something we've talked briefly about, and we did have a question come in, so I'll use that as my segue into talking about the states. But are any of the panelists aware of a consensus for updated language to comply with the new Washington state medical debt disclosure requirements that were enacted under HB 1531. Does anyone have any guidance or insights into how they're dealing with that, or should be dealing with that new law?
Silence is deafening. I don't. I don't know if ACA, I mean, they've got their 50-state guide, and it may be that they've updated that section to give you some direction, but I don't know Washington law.
They actually just released the new version of the ACA state. The updates just came out today, so you may want to check those. You can also look at Experian. They do a great job of sending out and listing different updates federally, and then they also break it down by state. ERC doesn't do health collections, unfortunately. I feel bad. I gotta leave you hanging on that one because I'm not sure necessarily. But yeah, I would say start with ACA, check out Experian, and see if you can't get some assistance with that.
Excellent. Thank you. This is something we talked a little bit about with the model validation notice from the CFPB, but there are times, and there are agencies out there that sometimes try to soften the content of a collection letter. Maybe trying to use plain English instead of legal jargon, especially with some of the statutory language. Is that an approach that either of you would recommend or any of you would recommend or endorse?
You know, this is Michael Clutho again. I always would ask the question, you know, if you're going to do this sort of thing and change things up and legal jargon, non-legal jargon, run experiments at least. If you think you've got the secret sauce and this language is really going to, put you over the top and be the best agency as far as collection rates, run an experiment. You've got, 1,000 accounts, put 500 in with the one version and 500 with the other version and see if there really is any difference and change opinions with facts. And if there really is a change, then, obviously both before and after working with your lawyer. But I always hear, I don't do collections, but I always hear letters don't collect debts. And I don't believe that's really true. I think letters do collect some debts. Some people will pay off of a letter. But I'm not so sure it's the wording of the letter. It's just the matter that they've gotten a letter from a collection agency. So that's not anything legal or anything like that, other than when you do start changing up the language that the statute says to use, you do run the risk that you're going to get challenged on that in a class action. So do that with caution.
I completely agree.
I'll only throw in there that, yeah, I agree. I wouldn't change a single thing out of the statute as it's currently written. Up until the day that the proposed rulemaking goes into effect as a final rule, because if you look at that Exhibit B, you will see one clear thing. It's in plain English. They eschew the strict statutory language that everyone's been citing for the last 40 years. It's not in there. They've converted it to a plain English version, but I wouldn't use it until they put it out there officially because of everything we've talked about with the safe harbor. But if you want to see a direction that the singular enforcement body dealing with this statute and interpretive body is doing, they're trying to put it into plain English. So. If you want to be a trailblazer and start early with it and go back to Exhibit B as your defense, maybe we can get a good reported case. And I'm sure Mike would like to put on his accountsrecovery.net, agency wins using CFPB language before notice of rulemaking is put into effect. Be a great headline.
See, the headline writes itself.
There you go.
Rick, I wanted to go back to something you mentioned earlier because you raised a topic that I hadn't thought of, and I'm man enough to admit it. But the notion of current creditor and how to identify the current creditor in a lawsuit, or sorry, in a collection letter, has certainly been the subject of a number of lawsuits. What insights can you share on that topic?
Well, either fortunately or unfortunately, I've had a lot of experience in this issue. All over the country, New York, given the areas of, and in New Jersey, where we just have a couple plaintiff's law firms that really, really harp on adequately expressing the identity of a current creditor in the collection notice. And I also had the good fortune of arguing a case before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and prevailing on identification of a current creditor. What does the statute say? The statute in 1692G A2 says the debt collector has to send a consumer a written notice containing the name of the creditor to whom the debt is owed. It's really, basically has been interpreted to mean the current creditor. So what do we have? We have a rash of litigation that says by putting multiple names in there, by not clearly identifying who the current creditor is, by using your own name as a collection agency, you in fact may be confusing the consumer into being able to identify the creditor to whom the debt is owed. Particularly when we use things like my client has asked me to collect, or other language like that, you could understand in some cases how that could be not as clear cut as we all like it to be. There is no requirement that you use magic words like current creditor, although it is my recommendation to do so, because it just makes everything easier. The current creditor, putting that entity's name not putting servicer, provider, hospital, Ray, colon, using the words parent credit. And then when you identify your client, instead identify, we have been retained by the current creditor. So courts haven't been as strict as that, but those are the safest language. Really, it comes down to how many names you're using, how you are identifying it. And in our case in the Seventh Circuit, was a scenario in which it was a branded product, PayPal Credit. And PayPal Credit was identified as the client. The creditor, or original, they wrote original creditor, which there had not been a change, was identified as Comenity Bank. And plaintiff sued saying, well, it's confusing because I don't know who the creditor is. And it says original creditor. And by using the word original, that presumes that it was transferred or sold at some point in time. And the Seventh Circuit, of course, we had three cases, one in Florida, one in Wisconsin, one in Illinois. Got summary judgment in all three. In Wisconsin and Illinois, they were appealed and consolidated. And the Seventh Circuit ultimately concluded that the district judges were right by identifying clearly the brand PayPal Credit, which was the most identifiable name that helped the consumer know what the debt was, and identifying the creditor as original creditor, even though nothing had changed, there was no confusion to the consumer, and it was upheld. That would be listed if anyone's looking them up at Smith versus Sim Associates. The fact is there's a lot of litigation on it. Be as clear as possible. Try to limit the number of entities you're identifying in your letter, and be careful about word choice to avoid suit. But they are defensible cases, except in those scenarios in which you are really putting a lot of names in front of the consumer and are not clear who it is that's asking for the debt to be paid.
Great. Thank you for that comprehensive analysis. Michael, Shelley, anything else you want to add on top of Rick's perspective on this notion of a current creditor in a collection letter?
I think Rick was spot on.
Yeah, I was going to say we've had several cases which have benefited from the cases that were mentioned by Mike, where we've been sued for not properly naming the current creditor, and those have since been dismissed. So,
excellent, good news. Michael, I want to circle back to something you said earlier. Now it's your turn. The notion of a one-size-fits-all letter. I was wondering maybe if you could spend a minute talking about the pros and cons of that approach versus a collection letter for every season.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I have this discussion. I don't do collections, so when I give advice, it's not necessarily practical advice. And clients tell me that all the time. But if I'm an agency that does different things. So for some clients, I'm going to credit report. For some clients, I'm not. Some clients, I'm going to continue adding interest. Some clients, I'm not. Some I'll add service fees on, collection fees, and some I'm not. So there's all these, you get into that kind of myriad of variables in there. And then you try and make all that work in a single letter. And it just really doesn't work. I mean, there's a saying about one size fits all, fits none. And a lot of times if you ever buy tools and this is a supposed, it does 10 different things, it won't do any of them any good, any of them well. So I'm a firm believer in if you can start segregating your accounts into clients into buckets. So if I have a static account bucket where that's the dollar amount, it's never going to change, that's going to look like one letter. And it may even say in the letter that, that this account will not accrue interest or any other charges. That's the amount, you can see what I'm getting at. So that it's just as blunt as you can be that's what you owe. And then another letter that would be a different letter, and it would have interest, and it would specifically indicate that interest is accruing. You get into the Miller versus McCalla language and things like that's now being challenged because Judge Posner gave us, interest, fees, other charges, when in fact, and then in the Boucher case, the judges said in the Seventh Circuit, well, there were no other fees or charges that could have been. It was only interest, so you shouldn't have been talking about that. And so, you know, the consumer lawyers are always looking at your letters even harder than us defense lawyers are when we're giving you risk management, because they love class actions. So the upshot of all of that is wherever you can, try and come up with, if you will, a letter that fits your specific client or groups of clients that fall into those buckets. And I think that, you know, you're going to be better served in the long run. That's all said. And people tell me it's not practical, Clutha, that we can't do it. So.
at least they're honest.
Yeah. Well, that's when I come up with things like then putting at least not applicable, NA or something, because if you're telling me I'm going to try and lessen your risk, if I can't do what I can to help you try and almost eliminate it, I will at least lessen it. So you kind of two different slices at it.
Shelley, as the representative on the panel from you know, and the in-house perspective, and, you know, Michael mentioned consumer lawyers or someone, you know, we're always sort of wary of. I'm curious if there are any trends or any new wrinkles that you've seen or heard of, you know, with respect to letters that consumer attorneys may be focusing on today, what that next new trend might be for them, to the extent that you know or are willing to share.
Well, I would say that what seems to be popping its head up a little bit more is has to do with having multiple addresses on your letters. There was a case, it's Saraci, I'm probably not pronouncing it right, it's Saraci versus Convergent, that kind of was the first of these that we could find anyway. And it's a good example on what to see what the suits actually look like. So copy and paste all of those pleadings and slap them onto David Barshay and Sanders' email address, and that's what you're going to see coming in your mailbox for some goofy reason. The thing that they're kind of zeroing in on is a lot of our letter vendors have an address that's listed on the letters, and it's a P.O. box, and ERC quite literally says, do not send correspondence to this address, and then ERC lists the addresses where you points the consumer to the correct address in several spots. But having that other address on there is being listed as confusing. So, and then in one communication, it was even pointed out that there are addresses included in the disclosures, which are the requirements from the states that give a listing of, you know, their addresses or where your resident manager is. Colorado is an example. I guess, like, just saying that people that want to dispute in writing don't know where to send their dispute. So that seems to be the new trend. We've got a couple of them already, actually. We think they're very ridiculous and fully intend to defend them, based on that. So I asked for current case law, which would establish that position, and anything that would at least help us understand how the consumer came to be so confused. And what was offered to me was a citation that was embedded in a plaintiff's appeal or motion to appeal their complaint. So I'm not sure if that was just too much to handle for this particular firm or what was going on. So we just don't think it's going to stick.
That would be good news.
That's our latest and greatest, yeah.
Rick, as someone on the outside, are there any other trends you're seeing or hearing from either your clients or just sort of within the industry that you want to, you know, sort of put a spotlight on right now?
Well, I mean, let's say it's a trend. It's happened for a while, but I think everyone's really got to be cognizant of it, which is this concept of contingent fees and collection costs. We always see these cases pop up here and there, and they go in waves. And quite frankly, the the courts buy into the argument a little too frequently, for my liking. But the general gist behind it is collection agency has a contingent agreement with its client, creditor client, that says we don't have to, we, you, the creditor, don't have to pay us until we collect money. The agreement with the creditor and the consumer is you have to pay any collection costs we incur. The collection agency sends out the letter, says, you know, you owe $100 and you owe us $25 for collection costs, so you do now $125. Claimant says, well, I don't owe you the $25. It's not due now because I haven't paid anything yet. It's a contingency. I don't owe you the money until after I pay. So by saying that you do now is deceptive and misleading. And so that timing sequence of suggesting that something is due now or due at all, and it's based on a contingency, unfortunately, we've seen a number of judges that denied motions to dismiss on this concept, and have suggested that, in fact, saying it's due now is deceptive and misleading. The alternative to that, of course, is to collect the $100, hang up the phone, call them immediately back and say, well, now you owe $25, of course, which would result in a lawsuit that said you failed to disclose what was owed, and I thought I was done and over after I paid you the $100, now you say I owe $25. At least there was one opinion, I think it was the Eastern District of New York, in which a judge talked about just that scenario and said it would be foolhardy to do anything other than to disclose the owing of the money and the potential for the collection cost to have to be recouped at the time of sending your letters and not after the fact. But it's an issue, and I think you're going to see it get a little bit more widespread, and hopefully there'll be a few more judges that understand the practical implications of what they're ruling.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We've only got a minute or so left, but before we wrap up, I'd like to go around the panel one more time and maybe get each of you to share some key takeaways, the sagest of your sage advice, anything you didn't get a chance to talk about but wanted to address because you thought it was important, or just some concluding remarks, if you don't mind, before we depart for the day. Michael, would you mind kicking us off?
Yeah, I would just say this, as you gathered from our conversations, there is constant change when it comes to letters. Consumer lawyers love them because it gets some class actions. So if there's one thing that you get as far as a takeaway is you do need to have your letters reviewed very regularly. And Rick mentioned at least once a year. And frankly, it's got to the point where you're almost needing to do those, you know, on a quarterly basis to get a quick gut check to make sure your letters are still compliant with newest cases coming down.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Shelley?
I kind of second that, and I'll just build on that too. You know, make sure that you use the tools that are available to you. You know, go to the ACA and double check their website and the compliance tools that are available there, as well as InsideArm. There's a spot in InsideArm that gives recent cases, whether they have a positive or negative impact on your industry. We use those tools to try to help us adjust our priorities as far as letter changes. It is a constant thing. It's an ever-changing animal, and I don't think reviewing your letters too often is a thing.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Rick?
My piece of advice to everyone, obviously given what's at stake with letters, meaning i.e. class actions that can result from the lawsuits, is to remember that your letters, when it comes to potential for lawsuits, are not being brought, the lawsuits are not being brought by plaintiffs, they're being brought by plaintiffs' lawyers, they're being interpreted by judges, and you can't think that you are communicating with the consumer when you're writing the letter. You need to have your letters reviewed. You need to keep in mind that you are communicating with plaintiff's lawyers and you are communicating with judges. And the letters need to be compliant from their perspective, not necessarily simplistic, common sense language, because we all know, Michael and myself included, that we lawyers tend to twist some words, add a few extra meanings to it, you're on a different playing field when it comes to sending out letters. They are not directed to consumers. They are directed to lawyers and judges. So keep that in mind when you have them written and reviewed.
A very good way to tell people to look at it. Well, Shelley, Michael, Rick, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. Appreciate your participation. Each of you were truly awesome. So thank you very much. Really appreciate it. I also want to thank CompuMail one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.compumailinc.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey that should be popping up on your screen momentarily or showing up in your email inbox tomorrow. For anyone who wants to review a recording of this or share this with others, a recording will be posted to accountsrecovery.net later today. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panel, thank you very much. You guys were awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Everybody else, enjoy the rest of your day. Take care.
Bye-bye.